Tereo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout. And today it's a D-Day. Well, it should be a W day because it's Word Day. Word Festival program has just been announced, and I'm talking with Karen Das, the clever woman who's put it all together, about all the delights that are in the program. Please get your programs and please start booking soon because some of these events are going to sell out quickly. But also to publicise the Word Festival, I'm playing two interviews with two of the writers that are coming. Catherine Chidgey, her new novel has gone ballistic. It's selling like crazy and people are loving it. She will be at the festival. And Duncan Sarkis, whose book about alpacas came out early in the year, has amused and delighted people as well. And he's going to be here doing a workshop and also in various other events. It's an annual pleasure to have Karen Das from the Word Festival in to talk about the program for the festival, which has just been announced. And can I say first up, Karen, that I'm super excited that you've got the Australian writer Charlotte Wood coming.
Kia ora, Maureen. It is so lovely to be with you here again. Thank you for having me to talk about the program. Yes, Charlotte Wood, huge author, Booker Prize shortlisted for her extraordinary novel, Stoneyard Devotional. Really looking forward to having her in a couple of sessions at Word.
Yes, a couple of sessions. That's what we like to see. Because if you miss one, then, of course, there's an extra chance. She's going to be on her own, isn't she?
She will be on her own in conversation with Emily Perkins. So that's a really great pairing.
Oh, my goodness,
right,
yes.
Right there, really dynamic duo. And she will also be on, I think, a star-studded, really, panel, Queens of Atmosphere, with of course, the extraordinary Catherine Chidgey and Michelle Duff. And those three authors, I think, are really powerful and skilled at writing novels that are steeped in atmosphere and interesting characters and a strong sense of place.
Gosh, yes. And Michelle Duff has had a lot of press lately. I've read her book, interviewed her. I think it's a stunning collection of short stories. So I'm pleased to see that she's dotted all over the place in this program.
Yeah, she's doing a bit for us.
She sure is. There's, you know, a mixture of our old favourites, The Cabinet of Curiosities, The Risky Women. There's Poetry Slams, there's the Zine Fest over at the Art Gallery. But you've got some new and exciting ones coming up, I think.
I'm glad to hear it. I think so too. So, you know, we've got our classics, but also the creativity and innovation that Word is known for, I think. I'm really looking forward to, I don't think people will want to miss this, Chris Teese's Love at First Line, a poetry dating game, and also Tom Sainsbury, the absolutely hilarious comic, is doing a wonderful panel about reading, and it's his Reading Enthusiasts Soiree.
Yeah, I'm very taken by that because he's got Kate DeGoldie, a recent, re-arrival here. She's come home. Rachel Paris, who I'm going to be talking to, who's just written a really stonking good page-turning thriller. And Josiah Morgan, who's Kaitahu, Ngāti Mani o Portal. So there's a really good range.
And what unifies them is that they're three really good and passionate readers, and they will have a lot to say. And I think they'll have a lot of fun as well.
I don't think you could help having fun with Tom Sainsbury. Good to see things like the spin-off live program back again.
Yeah, so we've got our friends at Gone by Lunchtime, the fantastic political podcast at the spin-off, coming back to do a kind of scene report on where we're at and where we're going, the political landscape. Really interesting too. It's local elections as well. And we last had them in 2023.
Look, I went to that and it was hilarious. So that's getting a big tick from me. State of the Nation's media on Friday, the 29th of August.
Yes, I think that's a health check of the State of the Nation's media. And that is a heavyweight lineup on that panel. It's Toby Manhire from the spin-off, Kamala Hayman, who is editor of The Press, Paul Thompson, who is the CEO of Radio New Zealand, and also Miriama Alexander, who is an extraordinary presence in the media landscape in New Zealand, former head of New Zealand Herald. So she's a recent transplant to Christchurch too.
Well, what a good, they're coming from every sort of area of the media, and we are always on alert for what's going on there because ructions, money, worries, everything.
Absolutely, and just such a rapidly changing landscape, and they're all extremely experienced and knowledgeable. So.
Now, I should say you've got some heavyweights coming, Dame Anne Salmon.
Yes.
Talking with Te Māori Doe from Naitahu.
I think Dame Anne Salmond is such a national treasure, and whenever she has something to say, we need to listen. She's just a phenomenal anthropologist and thinker, and I think that will be a really important and really engaging session.
Well, I'd love to say I will be in the front row for that, but it clashes with me doing my session with Rachel Paris.
Oh, I'm so sorry, but
that's all right.
There will be some sessions available to watch on demand as well.
Well, that's good to know, because that is absolutely important to me, because I can't miss my own show, can I?
No, you can't. And it's great. You're doing a bit for us as well, Maureen.
I'm really looking forward to the ones I'm doing.
Yeah.
And let me talk just briefly about the one that you've asked me to do with Damien Wilkins and Lawrence Fernley.
Yes.
I was so thrilled to get that offer.
Oh, I'm so glad. I thought you were the perfect person for that. And I think it will be a really lovely session. I really recommend people go to this one. It is in praise of gentle fiction. Now, Damien Wilkins, of course, won the 2025 Jan Medlicott Acorn Prize for Fiction at this year's Ockham New Zealand Book Awards for his novel Delirious. And it is such a... I'm so thrilled with that. And
me too.
It is such a powerful, observational, gorgeous, beautiful novel that I think I recommend it to anyone to read. And but it's a quiet book. It's not a shouty book. And the same as Lawrence Fernley's At the Grand Glacier Hotel. It's one of those ones that really stays with you long after you've finished the final page. Mm. And I think that's what unifies the two books, which, of course, both of them were sort of stemmed from pretty, powerful personal life stories behind that. So I think that will be a lovely
I'm looking
session.
Forward to doing my homework on that.
Yes.
And going back to those books, because I absolutely agree with you. They're just wonderful. Epic Adventures with Naomi Arnold and Kate Evans.
Yeah.
And Kate has just been announced as one of the 10 authors of note.
That's right, the new voices. Yes. Through the Coalition of Books, which is a great new initiative. Great diverse lineup of authors on that. So people should check that out at the Coalition of Books. So Kate Evans is an amazing science and kind of nature environment writer, as is Naomi Arnold. They both write a lot for New Zealand Geographic, and and they're good friends, and they're currently working on a travel book together.
Oh, boy.
Each taking care of, one's doing North and one's doing South Island. And I thought it would be really nice to get the two amazing writers who are friends in conversation with each other about their books.
I think that'll be a must-go too. I'm going to be talking to the legendary, another Taonga, literary Taonga, Gavin Bishop, and that's going to be a joy because I think I've known Gavin since 1976. I was just trying to work out.
It's amazing. You'll have so much to talk about. I think it's really special for us to be able to celebrate Gavin Bishop, who is just such a, he's got so many awards to his name.
Boy,
and every book he does just is, you know.
He's a perfectionist. Yeah. Now, tell me about This Band Could Be Your Life.
Oh, so This Band Could Be Your Life is for the music lovers, of which our audiences love music, as do I, and it is a panel of writers delivering a love letter to a musician or a band that means a lot to them. And I really like sessions like this because it shows writers from a different perspective, a different angle, their musical lives, which is often quite a personal thing. So you can expect to hear some music and to see some images and maybe learn a new favourite.
That's wonderful. And two, well, I think there's more, but I'll just quickly mention two art-related ones. One is Eden Hoare, that marvellous new book about the farmer who collected all the spangly and glam dresses. And that, you're going to have the authors of that there. And you're going to have some of their costumes as well.
So this is a very, very, very special session that people who love fashion history of Aotearoa and also social history won't want to miss. Eden Hoare, of course, was the Central Otago farmer who housed a collection, actually the most significant couture collection of garments in Australasia, one of the most significant collections, something like over 220 high-end fashion New Zealand-designed garments that we might not have collected today if he hadn't done
Wouldn't have.
He housed them in his tractor shed that was a makeshift museum. And there's an exquisite book called about him, Eden Hoare, Central Otago Couture. And the authors of that book will be in conversation with beautiful images, but also we're so lucky that we have some of the garments coming and will be on display. So you can see them in real life.
Oh, I can't wait to see them and see which ones they've chosen. And the other one I was going to mention is Toi Tamana, an Indigenous History of Māori Art, which won the prize, didn't it, for was it illustrated non-fiction?
Illustrated non-fiction at the Ockham New Zealand Book Awards, and it is just a real landmark publication celebrating different disciplines of Māori art in Aotearoa New Zealand, and so that will be a really special visual and informative session.
I know we're running out of time, but just have to mention the mischievous Steve Brawnius, who's going to be talking about the Polkinghorne trial that he spent day after day attending.
Well, he has a very unique perspective of that trial from an insider's account, having covered it so extensively. And, you know, it was one of the most had people sitting on the edge of their seats, really. One of the most kind of talked about cases in our recent history. And, of course, he's a fabulous true crime writer.
Is he not? And you know, you can't miss one of those sessions because he'll say something very provocative.
You never know.
No, Ngāi Tahu, of course, has got a real presence in our program.
Absolutely, and I'm really excited to have Athol Anderson on a really powerful panel. His book, The Welcome of Strangers, is just being republished, so we can celebrate that. And that is a really special event to close the festival this year.
Brilliant. Of course, there's plenty for kids and teenagers.
Lots for younger people. We have partner up again with Ototahi Zine Fest, and we have our Rangatahi Boogie with Loopy Tunes and our Inspiring Minds.
Gosh, I know what it feels like to put this jigsaw together, so congratulations, Kieran. I think you've done a remarkable job of pulling in, this. We are publishing so many good books, and it must be a nightmare to have to say no to so many, but you've given us a huge chance to see some remarkable writers and listen to our great minds. Now, the dates are?
So the dates are the 27th of August to the 31st.
And go on the website?
Pop on the website, wordchristchurch.co.nz, and sign up to our e-news for any updates. And the launch has happened, so program is out in the world, so book away.
Book indeed. I will see you all there. This is the best antidote to a long, cold winter and a fresh new spring.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM. Streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
We have a literary superstar in our midst, writer and critic Steve Brawnius declared when Catherine Chidgey's new novel, The Book of Guilt, was published. Catherine's literary reputation is such that this book has already been published internationally and is a bestseller here. Steve also described her books as inspiring a feverish quality in her readers. And I think, Catherine, this was in evidence in your being at the Auckland Writers' Festival. You were there for hours, signing people's books and receiving their praises?
Oh, yeah, thanks, Morin. It's really lovely to be chatting with you again. Yes, the Auckland Writers' Festival was a blast. The book had only just been released, so it was new to readers. And, the session itself felt like a real celebration of the book. And then afterwards, the signing queue did go out the door of the Aotea Centre and into the rain.
Well, feverish quality indeed. People always like to know where books start, and you have had such a prodigious outpouring of writing and books in the last however long it's been. And where would this book have slot into all the work you were doing? Was it sort of needling away at you as you were writing your other books?
Yeah, it was. I started thinking about it, or I had the seed of an idea for it when I was writing my two books set in Nazi Germany, The Wish Child and Remote Sympathy. And like a lot of other writers, I started thinking about what would the world have looked like if World War II had ended differently. And lots of writers have been down that track before. But with my story, I wanted to think about what would have happened, or how would England have looked in particular if they'd been forced into a treaty so that they hadn't won the war and Germany hadn't won the war and nobody had really won. And concessions and sacrifices had to be made on both sides. How would that have looked? So in my version of history, Hitler is assassinated at the end of 1943, and after that the powers meet to establish this treaty. And when I was researching those two earlier books, The Wish Child and Remote Sympathy, a question kept coming back to me, which is how can we ever ethically make use of the various research that was conducted during the war? And that's probably as much as I'll say about that, because I don't want to give anything too much away about the Book of Guilt. But that knotty question, which, yeah, can never really be answered satisfactorily, was something that got under my skin. So that was also a starting point for the story and the world of the Book of Guilt.
Yeah, and also another thing that you explored in Remote Sympathy is when do ordinary people say, this is not on, I can't, you know, I can't look away any longer from what is happening.
Yeah, or I can continue to look away and feel a little bit uncomfortable about it but keep pushing it to the back of my mind. Yeah, that was a central concern of Remote Sympathy, and is also something that threads its way through the Book of Guilt. So it's set in a version of Britain in 1979, and the local people are aware of these children's homes that come under something called the Sycamore Scheme that was established after the war by a lauded doctor and scientist, Dr. Roach. But the general public don't really know what goes on in the homes, or choose not to know what goes on there. And the children themselves, who have been raised in these homes, don't really know the truth of them either. So the story is told from the point of view of Vincent, who is one of a set of identical triplets living in a Sycamore home. And at the time of the start of the book, the homes are about to be closed down by the new government, and the remaining children, the few remaining children, are going to be released into the community, and homes found for them with families. And so this is starting to raise the hackles of the community, because up until now they have been able to look away, and now they can't. So, yeah. Part of the story is told by Vincent, who's really the main narrator, and then there's also a strand that's told by a woman called the Minister of Loneliness, whose job it is to oversee the rehoming of the children. And then there's also a third narrator called Nancy, who's a 13-year-old girl living with her parents, her very overprotective parents. They've never let her outside their property her whole life. And gradually these three strands begin to intersect, and we find out what's been going on, just as the characters do.
And very cleverly done, may I say. Now, I was in Britain in the 1970s as Thatcher was in power, and so there was so much in that book that reminded me of what it felt like at that time. And also, I spent 6 years in a boarding school, so the opening paragraphs of the book just put me immediately back into what it felt like to be. Fortunately, it was, well, fortunately a different, what am I trying to say, different. I'll just leave it at that, but you know, it's one thing to do all the research that you do and you're meticulous at it and you love it, but it's quite a different thing. It's an elusive thing that gives the book authenticity, that makes you really feel like you know what's going on. How do you sort of walk that fine line between having all the information that you've gathered but knowing how to put it into the book?
Yeah, I do become quite dogged with my research. I love the thrill of the chase. I love trying to find out, well, you know, exactly what sorts of biscuits would they have eaten at afternoon tea in the New Forest in 1979, or what things would have been available in a bakery in a New Forest town then. So I love finding out those things. And I also love those moments when something just falls into my lap that I haven't been looking for and I realize is going to be really important to the story. With every novel, I end up with a file of research notes to myself that is two or three times the length of the book. So it is a matter of sifting, and you can't put everything in and you shouldn't put everything in, but it's a matter of choosing those details that, I don't know, have the most resonance for me or seem granular enough to build a really convincing three-dimensional world. And with this world, you know, it is an alternative history, but it's also mapped very closely to the real world. So I have the real TV shows that were on then, like The Two Ronnies or The Generation Game or Antiques Roadshow. And I have people wearing what they would have worn and eating what they would have eaten and reading the books that they would have read. But it also is sort of disturbingly skewed as well, this reality.
Yeah, and that's another thing that you are extremely adept at is dropping in those what's the technical term for them? It's like clues or something unsettling that you think, oh, hang on, this is not right, this is not good. What's the technical term for what you do when you sort of, it's like it's like you're the Wicked Witch and you're just dropping the little bits of, or whatever she was, little sort of bits of biscuit for us to follow along in our trail.
Yeah, I don't know what the technical term is. I'm sure there is one, but I loved that process, particularly with this book, of withholding knowledge and knowledge and the withholding of it is a central theme in the book too. So the boys are only allowed to read or only have access to a children's set of encyclopedias, rather outdated, called the Book of Knowledge. And that's what makes up their library. They have no other books. And gradually, you know, they start to thirst for more knowledge and start to question everything that they thought they've known. So I loved dropping those little clues and not being too overt about the truth, but rather just tripping the reader up now and then, I suppose, and having them think, oh, hang on, I just read over something that sounds a little bit strange. And wait, is that actually how it was in England in 1979? No, I don't think it was. But and just to unsettle them like that. Yeah, I took great pleasure in that process.
Well, it is extremely unsettling. You know, we have a desire for when you start empathising with certain characters, you have a desire for them to be safe and protected, but all the time you're thinking, oh no, this is not looking good, it's going it's going. And when you bring in people like Jimmy Savile, and we know what an evil manipulative person he is, and we keep and immediately think, oh goodness, no, please, not Jimmy Savile.
I guess that was one of those sort of moments of research where, because we didn't have that show here, Jim Will Fix It, which was Jimmy Savile's kind of, you know, his main vehicle to fame in the 1970s, I think. So we didn't have that on our TV screens here. And when I was researching, well, what would children have watched then in the UK? That was one of the most popular shows. And immediately when I read that, I realised, oh, okay, well, that is going to be another opportunity to plant some hints at terrible darkness that the characters at the time are not aware of.
Yeah, and the Moors murderers, I'll say no more. They were very much, you know, haunting us back in those days, absolutely. Margate, place I've been to, and been for the reasons, very much the reasons that you were probably drawn to it is the seedy underside and the faded glory of a seaside place. But in the book, it's seen as a golden sort of place where all will be well.
It is, and I think it kind of almost still was in the 1970s. Its popularity was definitely beginning to wane then as, cheap package holidays abroad became available, and that really was the death knell for seaside towns like Margate. I did audition different seaside resorts. I knew I wanted to have a seaside resort as the kind of reward destination for the children who throughout their lives are subject to a mysterious illness that they know only as the bug. And if a child recovers, then their reward is that they're allowed to go to Margate and live in the big house there and go to the beach every day and go to the amusement park. And so the reason that I settled on Margate was because I realised it had or has an amusement park called Dreamland, and dreams are really important in the book. Every day the boys, quote-unquote, mothers, so they're looked after by Mother Morning, Mother Afternoon and Mother Night, and every day their dreams are recorded in this ledger known as the Book of Dreams. So as soon as I realised that there's a place called Dreamland in Margate, that was obviously the place that I needed to choose. And it also has this amazing, mysterious attraction called the Shell Grotto, which is this subterranean, incredibly beautiful space of passages and chambers, and the walls and ceilings that have been dug into the earth are entirely covered with intricate mosaics picked out in shells. And nobody knows who made it, whether it was like a Victorian folly or whether it's much, much older than that. And I really loved the mystery of that. And the fact that it's subterranean as well, which suggests a kind of a burial or a concealment. That all appealed to the atmosphere of the book.
I have been in that place, and it is exactly as you described.
It is amazing.
Yeah, and made more amazing by the fact that, as you say, nobody knows who did it and why. So that makes it even better, doesn't it? We can't talk about endings, but was this a difficult... we can talk in the abstract. Was this a difficult book to end, or was it fairly obvious to you how you'd end it?
I always know quite early on how my books are going to end, or at least I know the kind of the emotional atmosphere of the ending. But I always knew the point that I wanted to get to with this book and with the characters in the final scenes. So I wrote the ending fairly early on, and every so often would let myself have a read of it, which felt like a bit of a naughty treat to be able to see, like, this is where you're going, this is where you need to get to. And then just figured out the most effective way of getting there.
This is an odd question to ask you, but has any aspect of the book that you expected people to pick up or interrogate, has any aspect of the book not been, I mean, you know what you intend, and it must be quite intriguing to see what readers and critics make of it.
One thing that I found really quite gratifying and quite entertaining was that several readers, including my American editor, who's a very, very experienced reader, thought that the Sycamore scheme was real, and they were Googling it to find out more about it, or that the homes were real, or that various kind of historical events that I've changed really happened. And were embarrassed to find that they didn't when they Googled. So I loved that. I absolutely loved the idea that I'd made them seem real enough in the book that they convinced some of my readers.
That is fantastic, isn't it? That's exactly what you want from it. Well, yeah. I guess you're off to do the rounds of the book festivals and are you travelling to England or America or anywhere like that to do events?
I am doing a bit of travel. I'm heading over to the Edinburgh Festival in August, and I'll be doing some things in the UK just before then. And then I've got loads of New Zealand dates in my calendar, and I'm not too sure how later in the year is going to look. So the book is not out in the US and Canada until September.
Thank you, Catherine, and thank you for another extraordinary book.
Oh, thanks so much, Maureen.
The book is called The Book of Guilt. It's by Catherine Chidgey and it's published by Te Heringa Waka Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Duncan Sarkis is a writer of novels, theatre and screen stories for film and television. He's won numerous awards, fellowships and residencies for all these genres, and he's responsible for entertaining us with shows like Flight of the Conchords and What We Do in the Shadows. And some of us have been lucky enough to listen to his audio series, The Mysterious Secrets of Uncle Bertie's Botanarium. I think I'm saying that right, aren't I? Yeah, got it. But this latest venture, his third novel, is called Stargazing, and it involves a mysterious disease, nefarious plots, ruthless characters, and censorship of the press, and all within the world of alpacas. Duncan, it was a little bit like Best in Show, a little bit like Pecking Order, which is a movie maybe not many people have seen.
I'm very familiar with that movie. It's a great movie. Everyone should watch that movie.
Exactly. But then it's a work of its own. But alpacas, what came first, story or alpacas?
For a long time, I'd had a desire to be a little bit more political in my writing, seeing what was happening in the world around me and feeling, as so many of us do, feeling so sort of powerless to what's happening and wanting to channel that into some kind of work that wasn't sort of didactic or finger wagging or, and so I figured out that making a small microcosm society was going to be the way to play out some of the things that I was watching, the sort of the petri dish that makes the Trumps of the world or whatever you want to call it. You know, it's not just Donald Trump. It's just all around the world. There's fragmentation. There's loss of the ability to debate ideas. There's so many things happening that are being corrupted and that I wanted to write about it. So that's coming from a very serious place, to be honest. And then I was looking for a microcosm, and I explored, you know, before I chose alpacas, I was looking at history professors and the historians to see what sort of backstabbing might be in the historian community. I was looking at optometrists. I was looking at tramping clubs, choirs. But the first time I went to an alpaca farm, it was just obvious this was the one. This was the vehicle that could hold it all, because I guess the alpacas, they're so cute and fluffy and beautiful that there's a kind of a we can't say Trojan horse, we'd say Trojan alpaca sort of feeling to it, that it feels like it's going to be very soft and fluffy, but inside there's things I've got to say or that I've got to explore. And you know, so it's sort of a very deeply serious book masquerading as sort of soft and fluffy and fun.
Yeah, I read it virtually in one sitting because it's so absorbing. And as you say, it's entertaining. It's very familiar. These are people we know and we've either worked with or lived with or come across. But then it's terrifying, as you say, in its universality. So I think people will take this book on and then just not be able to stop reading it once they start.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because there's examples of it in every, because it's that theory, everything that you see happening on a large scale, you can also see happening on a small scale. And so any of us that's ever been even close to, I don't know, a board or a committee or a group of people running a small organization, you know, there's lots of good, well-run organizations, but there's also a lot of stuff that goes down, you know, in all of these. So many people will find it very familiar on that scale. But of course, I'm operating at a larger scale, but that's down to the reader how they operate, you know, yes, in terms of the response.
Yeah.
That's their job.
Well, some of us are so shell-shocked by what's going on out there that we want to stay in the microcosm. we want to believe that there are ways out of this and not sort of expand it more broadly. But I think your writing just stops us staying small scale.
It's an interesting, if there's a response that's a little bit like, so one of my favourite movies is Dr. Strangelove and How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. I'm a kid of the, teenage years in the 1980s, but certainly the first time I ever watched Dr. Strangelove, it was still a very much a going concern, the idea of the planet, you know, all my dreams were of nuclear bombs going off behind Brockville, the suburb that I used to look across from in my hometown in Dunedin. And so when I think of Dr. Strangelove, like here's someone that's written about something so terrifying, and the only way they could go forward was comedy. You know, that was the vehicle. He chose comedy. He could have chosen many other methods, but he chose comedy for that because it was the best way to, I don't know, to show the absurdity of it. It's an interesting line to tread, you know. I don't really have an interest. I naturally write funny. I like, you know, writing vaguely comedic characters. But my goal isn't actually to make people laugh. I think the making people laugh is a tool to take them where I want to take them.
You know? Yes, one of my favorite parts of the book where I the place where I really laughed out loud, I chuckled a lot, and this is where I really laughed out loud. But then you come back to it at the end, and it's where, I don't think it's a spoiler alert, it's where Caleb decides he's going to get back at his wife by taking the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle.
Jigsaw puzzle, yeah.
And, well, I'm laughing now. But then you come back to it at the end and you realise that there's so much more than that just being, you know, a funny aside.
I don't think this will be too teasery or ruin things, but no. it's fair to say that to add a crucial point when something major has happened in the novel, the very next chapter has someone angsting over whether they should put the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle back together or not, and the repercussions of that. And they're even paralysed in that decision. And so, once again, I suppose by being so little, it says so much about the ineffectiveness of some people.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that bit made, coming back to it, you know, it could have been something lost that I just laughed at. And then coming back to it, you realise how many people are caught in that dilemma of knowing there's a right thing to do, but feeling so helpless at how they support the right thing or what they do to
That's right. And there are people who, for example, I look at myself and I go, who am I in that novel? You know, and because, you know, I'm definitely not, like, I've got so much admiration for the activists of this world and the people that really get out there and done it. And sure, I'm making my small contribution by what I can do. I can write some words, I can write a book and enter a conversation. And maybe that's the best way I can use my skill set to, you know, to weigh in there. But I really admire people that actually do something rather than people who write books about people that are actually doing something. And then you get this other class of people who think they were born to lead and they often just don't achieve anything. You know, I'm not even talking about the most evil people we can think of. You know, I'm sort of damning the sort of the faux liberal who sort of, I don't know, they're just so, they actually help these terrible things that are happening. They're actually a cog in enabling it because they provide a creditably easy to roll over opposition to everything you throw at them by not actually standing for the things that they should be standing for. So,
yeah,
you know,
standing there, wringing their hands and not, yeah.
Yes, yeah, for sure. You know, it's like, I don't know, no offence, Nancy Pelosi making a big display in a room of ripping up a document. Do you know what I mean? And, I mean, the optics looked great, you know, good for you, but also what have you done? You know, what's your actual contribution? Maybe she's made a good contribution. You know, like maybe we could debate that. But I tend to look at a lot of ineffectual people. And obviously, you can go as small as an alpaca society, or you can go all the way up into sort of world scale politics. But you'll see examples everywhere because that's the thing about it. It's human nature. All of these roles are human nature. And it's so hard for those that are brave and to make their stand, and they usually get sidelined as well. So,
well, you've got Wilhelmine the vet, who is, you know, who uncovers, you know, all the and is trying her best in her very dogmatic way.
Yeah, dogmatic. That's right. Yeah, she's not blessed with people skills.
No, but she knows the truth of what's been going on, but trying to garner. Well, she does garner support, but and then you have. I mean, my favourite characters is Daff and Pat at the Alpaca Breeders Journal. You wrote those for people like me, I think, Duncan.
I love Pat and Taff. I really fell in love with them the first time I knew I wanted to tell a media story, and I knew it was going to be set in a very sort of small magazine, but I still wanted it to work as a microcosm for the larger things that really large media corporations, you know, like Washington Post, et cetera, all those ones, the pressures they're coming under. So I wanted to write about all of that. But Pat and Taff, I just fell in love with it because I figured there might be two characters, and it was only the first time I wrote them that I realised you had this really silent one, this really quiet soul in Pat, who had a very vibrant mind. I think in terms of, I describe her as like a radio transmitter sending out all kinds of anxiety-making signals, and she's just off the charts fun to me. What Pat quietly does while Daff tries to keep moving things along. So, yeah, I love those two characters. I'm very affectionate towards them. As you can imagine, when you write a novel, these people, they become so much your friends as much as the people in your real life. So you just fondly, it's a lovely moment where you're writing and you know what Pat and Daff would do in this situation because you know them so well by that point. You know, so, yeah, they're real favourites for me too.
Alpacas are the stars of the show in some ways because they got this sort of other world. Well, the story behind them is wonderful, but they have this sort of way of communicating with each other in a sort of slightly ethereal way. Or am I just making that up?
It was an interesting thing, you know, because I have written some from an alpaca perspective, but didn't want to anthropomorphize too much. So wanted to sort of find the right balance. And there was the novelization of 2001, which starts with all those eight people at the very start, was an amazing piece of writing for me. So that I found that a really helpful guide to finding the balance. Because the types of intelligence they have, they really do have an intelligence. They have an intelligence of the land, of the smells, of what to do as a herd, how it all works, you know. So I loved writing from that perspective. And yes, the first time I met the alpacas, I fell in love with them really quickly. And then, you do. There's so much personality in those animals. But also the human relationships. I spoke to a vet and who was advising me, and he said, look, I said, are they the alpaca farmers, are they the sort of strangest lot that you have dealings with? He said at number one, he had cat ladies that had loads and loads and loads of cats. And number two, you know, like 20 cats, that sort of. Number two, he had goat people. He said goat breeders were one step more oddball than, and then alpaca was at number three. And I think it's because you're raising these animals that have a lot of personality, but you're not, it's very rare that people do alpaca meat. So they're not being raised to kill. So they do become pets. So you can have a herd of 30 animals, 50 animals, 70 animals, 100 animals. And these alpaca farmers, they'll know all of the names of every single individual animal and their personalities. And so it's a very, I don't know, there's a lot of personality going down and a lot of very funny herd dynamics.
Yes, pronking is a good one, isn't it?
And yeah, I'm glad you chose the G-rated item in the glossary to talk about as opposed to the other one. Yes, pronking is this lovely, merry little sort of dance they do. Imagine if in the dressage competition in the Olympics, if there was a moment where the horse could lift all 4 feet up in the air sort of gaily and really just run around expressing joy in that way. Obviously, that's sort of the opposite of dressage, I imagine. Which is all yes. But pronking is maybe the opposite of dressage.
Oh, gosh, yes, there's lots to love. I'd never really taken much notice of alpacas, I'm sorry to say, but now I will.
Had I. Nor had I. And now, now I know them well.
Yes, yes. And, the wonderful story of, or mythical story of alpacas and the colour. Well, that mountain of all the colours is real, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm
in
sure that
South
story
America.
Could be absolutely debated. You know, like I found something and it felt real enough, and I was looking for a real origin, beautiful origin story, and it felt like it just fitted really, really nicely in it. And I'm sure if we were to go to Peru, not many people would believe that story. It's true.
Oh, well, I did. I took it. Hook, line, and sinker.
I think we all need an origin story. There's something beautiful about an origin story. You know, I really wanted one. Because it's amazing to think that these alpacas, once again, we can play allegory land and we can have a guess of what they actually represent in the real world. But if we just think of the alpacas as of themselves, it's a remarkable story. You know, these sort of animals that survived in native to the Andes, probably most of them wiped out during the first colonization when the Spanish came over there, and then some end up on a ship and end up in New Zealand, you know. And I don't know, it's so sort of strange, but it kind of I don't know. I mean, that maybe that also speaks, you know, like I said, I'm Armenian. Told you that before, so you know, I suppose that's partially my story too.
Well, we're just about out of time, but I could see you. I think you workshopped a lot of this in some ways. That whole, the sort of big climax that it comes to is so well choreographed. It leads up to this, and obviously not going to say anything about it, but it's very masterly. Very, very well done.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I love that climax. I love how it you get to know so many characters during the book, and then in this chapter they all come together and they're all doing their thing. And things get wild. There's a whole section where things just ramp up and get wilder and wilder and wilder, and people's true colours are very much revealed in those situations. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So thank you. I do. I love those scenes.
Yeah, I can tell. And you know, I'm trying not to say cinematic, but it's running through my head all the things that happen at the end.
Yeah, I think it's okay for a book to be cinematic. Yeah. You know, like know people probably are wary to say that because they know that I've also been involved in films and that kind of thing. So you know, wary of the obviousness of it. But all the same, of course, you're trying to engage a reader's imagination to imagine this whole vast world. And so, Yeah, I enjoy cinematic writing. I enjoy cinematic music. I enjoy cinematic cinema. So, you know, I think it's nice that it's cinematic, yeah.
Duncan, thank you for writing this book, for entertaining us and for challenging us and writing a very serious piece of work at the same time.
Thank you very much, Maureen. Really lovely to meet you.
The book is called Stargazers. It's by Duncan Sarkies and it's published by Te Heringa Waka University Press.
And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.